Does anyone remember anything from yesterday's presentation? Yes, Paul.
The real knowledge is to become aware of Krishna's all-pervading presence.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. Would you like to say something about that? Why is that real knowledge?
It's real knowledge because if we observe the world and we can only become detached from the world when we see the essence of everything and not the shadow. If we see the essence, then we come to real knowledge.
Mm.
And then the detachment automatically follows.
Mm. Nice. And I was thinking when you mentioned that to see the world as it exists separate from Krishna is not truly seeing it. You don't have knowledge of the world if you see it separate from the fact that it is emanating from the spiritual world. It's Krishna's energy basically. And then if we see, so to see the world, even if we're a great scientist, we can't see it from the point of view of knowledge. So one level above seeing the world and studying the world and just seeing the matter part of the world is to understand how everything is spiritual. But that's also knowledge, but that's also incomplete knowledge. So true knowledge of everything, the most complete realization of all that exists in the material world is to see everything in relationship to the source of everything, to its source, to its the one who maintains everything, and to the one who destroys everything, to see everything in relationship to Krishna, knowing its relationship to Krishna. And then when we see that this world is in fact non-different from Krishna, it is not Krishna directly, but it is non-different from Krishna, then our relationship with the things of this world, it should change. Because now, under the influence of our incomplete knowledge, or we can say it under the influence of Maya, we see the world as independent of Krishna. And we see ourselves as independent of Krishna. And therefore, we try to enjoy the material world. So seeing it in relationship, a good example is, say, if I happen to leave my camera, Mataji, maybe you could talk about it all later. So if you see a camera out there, just lying down, you might pick it up and make sure no one's watching you. And of course, none of you would be like that. But some people might do something like that because they don't. But then, if you know, oh, this camera belongs to to me, then you might see it in a completely different mood. And if you liked me today, you would say, oh, I should give this back to Burijan. Because you'll see the camera not as separate energy just existing there, and since you came across it, it's for your pleasure. You use it as you want. But when you see it in relationship to its owner, then your relationship with the object changes.
I remember when I
first began chanting, I remember Rupa Nuga Prabhu saying, you appreciate the painting, but to really appreciate the painting, you have to appreciate the artist, the one who from out of his consciousness this painting has come. So a true appreciation of the painting will lead one to a deep appreciation of the artist. Because again, it is from his talent, from his consciousness, his ability, that the artwork has sprung. So yes, I found those qualities yesterday that we were hearing about in the second half of the of that chapter, quite intriguing. But then at the end, wonderful as those qualities were, Krishna said, to see good and bad itself is a fault. And after being so attracted to all those wonderful qualities, I felt that I had been caught by Krishna, that he caught me. What did he mean by that? So Uddhava has the, because naturally to live in this world, how could we live in this world if we don't see good and bad, auspicious and subasub, auspicious or inauspicious, how, right and wrong, how could we live in this world? How is it practical? So Uddhava has the same question. And he says, in the first verse, my dear lotus-eyed Krishna, you are the Supreme Lord, and thus the Vedic literatures consisting of positive and negative injunctions constitute your order. You are telling us, you're instructing us, guiding us how to act within this world through the Vedic literatures. And such literatures focus upon the good and bad qualities of work. So to ignore good and bad means to ignore Vedic literatures, which means to ignore you. So how could we do that, O lotus-eyed Lord? Because they're your orders. So we'll read the purport here. At the end of the previous chapter, Lord Krishna stated, guna dosha drishir dasho gunas tubaya varjitaha. Focusing upon material piety and sin is itself a discrepancy, since actual piety means to transcend both of them. Sri Uddhava now pursues this point so that Lord Krishna will give a more elaborate explanation of this difficult subject matter. Sri Uddhava states that the Vedic literatures, which constitute the laws of God, deal with piety and sin. Therefore, it must be clarified how one transcends activities recommended in the Vedas. How is it possible to go beyond what is stated as an injunction in Shastra, in the Vedas? Clear. According to Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, Uddhava suddenly understood Lord Krishna's purpose in the words he had just spoken, and to induce the Lord to elaborate upon this interesting point, Uddhava outwardly challenges the Lord's statement. Uddhava continues, and he's going to continue his questions even up till the fifth verse, he says. According to Vedic literature, the superior and inferior varieties found in the human social system, vanashrama, are due to pious and sinful modes of family planning, meaning different types of children are born out of different mixtures of parents. Thus, piety and sin are constant points in reference in the Vedic analysis of the components of a different situation, namely the material ingredients, place, age, and time. So there are proper and improper ways to do everything according to time, place, ingredients, the situation. So a good way to perform an act is to perform the act in such a way that it is pious or elevating. And a bad way to perform the act is to perform the act in an impious way, and the result of impiety is degradation in the future, degradation, a degrading situation, being placed in a degrading situation. Indeed, the Vedas reveal the existence of material hell, heaven and hell, which are certainly based on piety or sin. If we sin, we go to which one? A or B? B. We go to hell. And if we act so nicely, we go to heaven. So the Vedas talk about this, and it's all in which way, where you go. Read the end of the fifth canto of the Bhagavatam. It will be dictated by how pious or impious your actions are. So what is Krishna's meaning by saying to differentiate between pious and impious is itself a fault. Without seeing the difference between piety and sin, how can one understand your own instructions in the form of Vedic literatures, which order one to act piously and forbid one to act sinfully? Furthermore, without such authorized Vedic literatures, which ultimately award liberation, how can human beings achieve the perfection of life? They won't even know the difference between good and bad. So, if they won't know the difference between good and bad, how can they choose properly? How can they elevate themselves? And ultimately, the goal of the Vedic literatures and the ultimate goal is liberation through increasing amounts of piety. So how could we avoid pious and impious injunctions, and to differentiate them, how could we consider differentiating them between them as a fault? He's presenting strong arguments here. My dear Lord, in order to understand those things beyond direct experience, such as spiritual liberation or attainment of heaven and other material enjoyments beyond our present capacity, and in general, to understand the means and end of all things, the forefathers, demigods, and human beings must consult the Vedic literatures. They're our guide. They're the ones, they're the law books. They tell us what to do, what not to do. Which they're your own laws, for these constitute the highest evidence and revelation. So they bestow on one vision, because we can't, it bestows on us vision of things beyond our direct experience. So I can see, I directly experience my glasses and the cup and the yellow cloth over here, and I directly experience the lamp. But that doesn't mean that all in existence is within my direct experience, especially when it comes to time. I do something in this world and a light goes on, but later on the bill has to be paid in time. So I may not be conscious of that, but in fact there are results that we're not aware of in the present that come to us in the future. So by direct experience, we can't be aware of these things. We're not aware of the future, just through our simple intelligence. So the Vedic literatures tell us of the future consequences of our acts, both pious and impious. So this is the pramana. This is the evidence that gives us the ability. It gives us the wisdom to judge what we should do and shouldn't do. How can they be disregarded? So we'll read from the purport here and then move on to the last verse in Uddhava's question. One might argue that while human beings are certainly prone to ignorance, the elevated forefathers and demigods are considered to be all-knowing within universal affairs. If such superior beings would communicate with the earth, then everyone could bypass Vedic knowledge in achieving his personal desires. So this is, someone can write a science fiction book about this, how the extraterrestrials who know what's going on and how the universe works, they can tell us directly what to do and what not to do. People do these, by the way, it's already been done with channeling and things like that. And then one doesn't have to listen to the Vedic literatures. That one could argue this if one has that kind of concept. This concept is denied here by the word Vedas Chakshus. Even the demigods and forefathers have at best an ambiguous conception of supreme liberation. What does ambiguous mean?
Unclear.
Hmm?
Not accurate.
Yeah, I think unclear is, you know, yeah, ambiguous, mixed in conception. They don't know what the supreme liberation is. At best, an ambiguous conception that's not consistent. unambiguous would mean clear. Like Prabhupada's writing is mostly unambiguous about what you should do and what you shouldn't do. It's completely clear. But the demigods, because, and forefathers, because they don't know what the supreme liberation is, sometimes they'll give ambiguous instructions. And even in material affairs, they are subject to personal frustration. Although the demigods are all-powerful in awarding material benedictions to inferior species such as human beings, they are sometimes thwarted in their personal programs of sense gratification. So they are not the ultimate powerful. So one, this system that he's proposing, Uddhava's proposing, isn't going to be the ultimate system, and it's not going to surpass the Vedas. In other words, the necessity of the Vedic injunctions is proved. So how can we just ignore their definitions of right and wrong? And then the final verse of his question, text 5. My dear Lord, the distinction observed between piety and sin comes from your own Vedic knowledge and does not arise by itself. If the same Vedic literature subsequently nullifies such distinction between piety and sin, there will certainly be confusion. So on one hand, if they say this is good and this is bad, and on the other hand they say it doesn't make a difference between good and bad, then the result is going to be confusion, certainly. So we'll read from the purport here, just starting in a little bit down in the 5th line. The Vedic literatures are full of descriptions of piety and sin. But Lord Krishna's statement that one should transcend piety and sin is also to be understood as Vedic knowledge. Sri Uddhava has understood this point and therefore requests Lord Krishna to clear up an apparent contradiction. Ultimately, the material world gives the living entities a chance to satisfy their perverted desires and at the same time gradually achieve the liberation of going back home, back to Godhead. Thus, material piety must be considered a means and never an absolute end. And since the material world itself is not absolute, being temporary and limited, the personality of Godhead is himself the reservoir of all virtue and goodness. Those persons and activities that please the Lord are to be considered virtuous, and those that displease him are to be considered sinful. There cannot be any other permanent definition of these terms. So here it's moving towards the conclusion in the purport. What was that conclusion? But yes, what's the frame of reference of that? Did you want to say?
Same thing.
But there was a frame of reference in that. Why? That's the ultimate consideration. But what about the Vedic consideration? What did it say? Yeah, it's connected to the temporary world. So something could be temporarily good or temporarily bad, but really not connected to the true and ultimate good and or true and ultimate bad. What would be an example of that? An ISKCON example.
Regulated sense gratification.
Yeah, that would be an example. Yes, so in this... But that may be to bring us to the ultimate good. But the example I was thinking of, say, devotees were a real ISKCONI example. Devotees decided to distribute books in a place, Prabhupada's books, in a place that was illegal to do it. So according to the moral law, they were acting inappropriately. And perhaps even by acting inappropriately according to the moral law, the law of the state, they might get into trouble and they might have to get fined or something, and that wouldn't be fine at all. But according to the ultimate law, that this is pleasing to Krishna, then it was actually proper for them to do that. I mean, so there's obviously shades of knowing how to do things, and you have to know what's really pleasing to Krishna. But that would be a simple example. Things that are, or say if you're a good churchgoer for most of your life, And when you go to church, you take off your shoes or put. Now, what would happen if you took off your shoes when you went to church? They would think you're a hippie. And then, so what, a person like that, when he wears his shoes into the temple, and that's considered completely inappropriate. You're wearing those dirty things here, the things you've been walking throughout, who knows what you've walked in, and you're walking into God's place like that. So in one situation, something is good, another situation, it's bad. So the Vedas define that. So all these definitions of good and bad are meant to bring us to the only permanent, true definition of these terms, and that is what is pleasing to Krishna. Now, it's an interesting point, and it's so relevant to the 10th canto of the Bhagavatam. But let's continue and hear Krishna's own words in reply. What is he going to say? How is Krishna going to reply to this? How is he going to make the distinction between different levels of good and bad? And say that without discouraging people from following the good and bad of this world as a general principle, but not allowing them to follow the good and bad of this world when it contradicts the good and bad in relationship to Krishna. So let's hear what he says. My dear Uddhav, Uddhava called Krishna my dear lotus-eyed Lord, and he called my dear Uddhava, so very, because Uddhava was very dear to Krishna. We heard this in the earlier chapter. Because I desire that human beings may achieve perfection, I've presented three paths of advancement: the path of knowledge, the path of work, and the path of devotion. Bhakti-cha. Jnanam, karma, cha bhakti-cha. Beside these three, there is absolutely no other means of elevation. We'll read the purport here. Ultimately, the goal of philosophical speculation, jnana, pious regulated work, karma, and devotional service is the same, and that is Krishna consciousness. As stated by the Lord in the Bhagavad Gita, yayatam mam prapadyante tamsta taiva bhajamyaham mamavartnanavartante manusha partha sarvasha. All of them, as they surrender unto me, I reward accordingly. Everyone follows my path in all respects. Krishna is the only goal of spiritual realization. There is one goal. This is called, what's the words of the Bhagavatam that they describe this one goal of the one absolute truth, that non-dual substance. Advaya Gyan. There is a one substance, one ultimate person, that is the goal of all spiritual paths. But there are different paths. And according to how one approaches that path, that absolute truth, that supreme being, that supreme non-dual substance, reciprocates with the person who has approached them according to the methodology of approach, according to the mind and methodology of approach. Everyone follows my path in all respects, O son of Prita. Although all authorized processes of human perfection ultimately lead to Krishna consciousness or love of God, various performers have specific propensities and qualifications, and thus they gravitate to different methods of self-realization. So according to... Anyway, Krishna will explain it, so I won't speak in advance. Lord Krishna here describes the three authorized processes together in order to emphasize that their ultimate goal is one. At the same time, philosophical speculation and regulated pious work can never be considered equal to pure love of Godhead, as the Lord has elaborately clarified in the previous chapters. The word traya, or three, indicates that despite their ultimate oneness of purpose, the advancement towards Krishna, because it is a yoga ladder, not a yoga flat plane where all of them are exactly on the same level, but the ladder leads us from one to the next, from karma to jnana and yoga. And the previous chapters have spoken about this so many times, how karma leads to jnana, and jnana leads to devotional service, and jnana leads to devotional service, and varnashram is perfected in offering everything to Krishna, and jnana, and the four kumaras, the greatest of jnanis, they're engaged when they understood the process perfectly, and the goal. They engage themselves in hearing and chanting and glorifying Krishna, devotional service. So it's been explained so many times in every chapter, practically speaking, how jnana leads to bhakti. This is the goal. It's a ladder moving forward, up the ladder, towards Krishna. One cannot achieve the same result by mere speculation or piety that one achieves by directly surrendering to the personality of Godhead, depending completely on His mercy and friendship, on His kind disposition to the living entity. That's ultimately what we depend on. So that's bhakti, obviously. And then at the end of the purport, all three divisions of Vedic elevation depend completely on the mercy of Lord Krishna. One cannot progress along any one of these paths without the blessings of the Lord. Other Vedic processes, such as austerity, charity, and so forth, are included within the three primary divisions described here. So, everything is very clear and simple. Now, among these three paths, Jnana Yoga, the path of philosophical speculation, is recommended for those who are disgusted with material life and who are thus detached from ordinary fruitive activities. So a jnani is one who is renounced from activities. He doesn't want to participate in anything that is going to entangle him in any karma. So he renounces his prescribed duties, he renounces any activity to maintain himself and he's just completely renounced, and he engages his full-time in what we call mental speculation, or acting on the using one's intelligence to discriminate between himself and the world of matter. So he can understand that he is not of this world, that he is an eternal soul. And he shouldn't act as if he's a material body. So he's renounced from all sense gratificatory activities. He's renounced. So there are those seeking liberation from material activities who will tend towards the jnana path. They're renounced, they've decided, they've concluded that there's not a possibility for me to be happy anywhere in the material world by pursuing material activities. So I'm not going to engage in any material activity, because I know that all material activities end in misery. So I won't engage in any material activities. And the perfect example of that was the Avadhuta Brahmana, who was Dattatreya Rishi that we were introduced to at the beginning of the Uddhava Gita in the first few chapters. I'm not going to do anything to even maintain myself. By God's grace, everything will occur favorable. So the jnani, the one who has the adhikara for jnana yoga, you're disgusted with material life and detached from ordinary fruitive activities. No. Those who are not disgusted with material life, having many desires yet to fulfill, should seek perfection through the path of karma yoga. Quite a different mood than the jnanis. One, both are seeking perfection, but one acknowledges that he has material desires in his heart, and let me do it through the path of karma, karma yoga. But he's seeking perfection. And the jnani is seeking perfection through the renunciation of work, and the other seeking perfection through work itself. Now, 8. Yadritstaya. Yadritstaya is an important word. It's also used in the prayers of Mutrakunda in a significant way. But it means somehow or another, or good by good fortune. Sometimes it's translated as by chance. Yadritstaya mat katadhau adau, that somehow or another, by good fortune, jata shradas tuya pumam, if a person awakens shraddha in matkata, Krishna is saying, in Krishna kata, talking about me, na nivino nati shakto bhakti yoga asya siddhida. So he's na nivino nata shakto, that he has neither aversion or attachment to the material world, and then his path of gaining perfection will be bhakti yoga. So the third path, the mood of a person and the qualification of a person who engaged in each of the three paths has been given by the Lord. I'll read the translation here. If somehow or other, by good fortune, one develops faith in hearing and chanting my glory. So this is the essence of the path of bhakti yoga. Shravanam, kirtanam, Vishnu, smaranam. Such a person who has that faith, he accepts that if I can just hear about Krishna and chant about Krishna, that will bestow all good fortune. My consciousness will be filled with Krishna katha. Such a person, being neither very disgusted with nor attached to material life, he is neutral towards the material world. Such a person should achieve perfection through the path of loving devotion to me. So let me read a little from this Uddhava Gita. The word yadritstaya has been explained in the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. One develops faith in discussions of the Supreme Lord by the association of advanced devotees. This is the main criterion for developing faith in the nectarian glories of the Lord. By continuously hearing discussions of the Lord's transcendental name, fame, qualities, and pastimes, a faithful person gradually advances on the path of devotional service to the Supreme Lord. Only a faithful person is qualified to engage in bhakti yoga. Adosh shraddha. This faith is the actual distinction between the devotees and the karmis or jnanis. The word pumana, which is used here, is singular, and thus stresses that a devotee is very rarely found. A devotee is not overly attached to his material body, wife, and household, nor is he excessively detached. Those who are thoroughly indifferent to material life are eligible for cultivating jnana, and those who are thoroughly attached to the material way of life are eligible for engaging in karma. Those who are neither overly attached nor detached are eligible for executing bhakti. This is the difference between those who are suitable candidates for the three processes, karma, jnana, and yoga. So the essence of the adhikara for the practice of bhakti is shraddha. There's faith. And here, describing Krishna katha. Now,
Now he's going to describe in 9 through 11 something about the path of karma. And then after describing the path of karma, he's going to describe the path of jnana. And then bhakti. That will be tomorrow. Now karma, 9 through 11. As long as one is not satiated, or as long as one hasn't had enough of fruitive activities and has not awakened his taste for devotional service by Shravanam Kirtanam, Matkata Shravanadhova Shradayavana Jayate. Service. So here the person has not sat, he still has desires for fruitive activities, and he hasn't a taste for Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu, Samaranam. One has to act according to the regulative principles of the Vedic injunctions. Purport. So this is, again, the topic of karma yoga, who should perform karma yoga and how to do it. Unless one has developed firm faith in Lord Krishna by association with pure devotees. Whoops. And thus engage in full-time and devotional service of the Lord, one should not neglect ordinary Vedic principles and duties. As stated by the Lord himself, Shruti Smriti Mamai Vagye Yaste Ulangyavartate Agya Chedi Mama Dvaisi Madbhakto Apina Vaishnava. The Shruti and Smriti literatures are to be understood as my injunctions. And one who violates such codes is to be understood as violating my will and thus opposing me. Although such a person may claim to be my devotee, he is not actually a Vaishnava. The Lord here states that if one has not developed firm faith in the process of chanting and hearing, one must comply with the ordinary injunctions of Vedic literature. And at the end of this purport, Srila Jiva Goswami points out in this regard that when a person fully surrenders to Lord Krishna, he takes shelter of the Lord's promise to liquidate all other responsibilities and debts of the surrendered soul. The devotees thus become fearless by meditating on the Lord's promise of protection. Those, however, who are materially attached are frightened by the prospect of full surrender to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, therefore revealing their inimical mentality toward the Lord. I'm moving on in this karma yoga, talking about karma yoga. My dear Uddhav, a person who is situated in his prescribed duty, properly worshipping by Vedic sacrifices, but not desiring the fruitive results of such worship, will not go to the heavenly planets. Similarly, by not performing forbidden activities, he will not go to hell. So he's performing niskam karma. He's doing his duties because they are his duties. So from that platform, he doesn't get a fruitive result because he's not attached to the fruit. He's dutiful. One who is situated in his prescribed duty, free from sinful activities and cleansed of material contamination, in this very life obtains transcendental knowledge or by fortune devotional service unto me. So here's a junction point in this Niskam Karma Yoga, that one can, if one is performing Niskam Karma Yoga, he can either get transcendental knowledge because of his not being fruitive. Being fruitive in one's work means that the mode of passion is impelling one, and being non-fruitive, or just working dutifully, means that one, the mode of goodness is acting upon one. And sattvam sanjayate jnanam. So from the mode of goodness comes knowledge. So if one is practicing this karma yoga, then one can get knowledge, or, as it explains here, as Krishna is explaining, or by fortune, he can also get devotional service unto me. Jnanam vishuddham apnoti, he can attain pure transcendental knowledge, or mad bhaktim vad yadritstaya, according to one's fortune, one either gets one or the other. So what is it that makes one's fortune? Whether one gets great, great, great knowledge or devotional service to Krishna?
Association.
Basically association. Either previously or at the present. Because it depends on what we want, and what we desire, depends on our association. Because Krishna will give us what we want. So it's so important that what we desire properly, because Krishna will give us as according to our desire. So what causes us to desire one thing or another? I had one experience many years ago that really showed me an answer to that question. Is that I had, this is when it was so long ago that laptop computers were rare. And this was one of the first ones that came out with a color screen. I got a Toshiba with a color screen. It's probably four times as big as that. And it was new. And it was mine. And I was so happy. And then I visited a dear friend in his room, Krishna Chetraprabhu, and he had a different model, and his was a wonderful color laptop, but it also had a DVD player in it. And this was not even a video DVD, but it was, you could actually play, hear Prabhupada's chanting, and he was playing Prabhupada's chanting, and mine didn't have that. And in 5 seconds, I went from being completely satisfied with what I had to being completely unsatisfied with what I had. My desire changed just like that. And I was trying to like control myself, but I was completely unable. And I wanted it. I'm not his particularly. I didn't like knock him over the head and take his computer. I just wanted one, and then within a few months, one miraculously appeared for me, and I was so happy until I saw someone else's computer, because my hard drive was so small compared to that person's. But that's what happens. According to association, if our consciousness isn't right, and someone pointed out yesterday that unless we have satisfaction in our own heart, in our own service, if we try to get our satisfaction on external things, then we're always going to see someone who has something that we always wanted to have, or we're imagining it's better than what we have, or imagining it will award us pleasure that will fill up the empty parts in our dry desert-like hearts. So that principle, that association, is so important, because it affects and infects the heart with desires. It works in every way in our life. So it also can fill us with the desire, the deep desire to want to lovingly serve Krishna forever. So therefore, since that is the thing that makes us fortunate or unfortunate, we of course should be careful about our association. And we should also be practical in our dealings. I remember in the early days of the movement, the devotees were so, you know, we'd hear this point, and that, you know, you have to be careful, make sure you don't associate with materialists. Then the devotees would go home and visit their parents or something, and not talk to them or something. You're a commie. And drive everyone crazy. and cause so much problem to everyone. So one is situated in his prescribed duty, speaking about one practicing karma yoga. If he practices in a detached way, he can attain transcendental knowledge, or he can attain devotional service, depending upon his desire, depending upon his association. We'll read from the purport here. According to Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, this is about 6th line of the purport. According to Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, through transcendental knowledge, one obtains liberation, whereas through pure devotional service, one can achieve love of Godhead, in which liberation is automatically included. Both results are certainly superior to ordinary fruitive activities by which one tries to enjoy much the same things that animals do. If one's devotional service is mixed with a tendency towards fruitive activities or mental speculation, then one may achieve the neutral stage of love of Godhead, whereas those who are inclined to serve only Lord Krishna advance to the higher stages of love of Godhead in servitude, friendship, parental love, and the conjugal relationship. So here it's set out in front of us. And to make clear that we do have, that here we are as human beings with developed intelligence, and we have the ability to make choices, and we do have free will. So therefore Krishna says, the residents of both heaven and hell desire human birth on the earth planet. Because human life facilitates the achievement of transcendental knowledge and love of Godhead, whereas neither heavenly nor hellish bodies efficiently provide such opportunities. We'll read the short purport here. Srila Jiva Goswami points out that in material heaven, one becomes absorbed in extraordinary sense gratification. Well, what do you think about that? What happens if there is a train going to heaven right out there and we could have extraordinary sense gratification? And if no one was looking, probably there would be lots of people who would get on the train. Of course, I remember one time I was in Los Angeles, and this is another long time ago, and the movie Star Wars came out. And it was actually, they had the premiere showing before the actual opening. And everyone and all the devotees went to the premiere showing and all had a Krishna conscious reason why they had to do it. So maybe we'd also have a Krishna conscious reason why we'd want to get on the train to the heavenly planets. So we could distribute books on the train or who knows, whatever, do some research assignment to convince people that they shouldn't get on the train or something. But, I mean, extraordinary happiness, it's quite an expression. So, in material heaven, one becomes absorbed in extraordinary sense gratification, and in hell, one is absorbed in suffering. In both cases, there is little impetus to acquire transcendental knowledge or pure love of Godhead. Excessive suffering or excessive enjoyment are thus impediments to spiritual advancement. Because when we're suffering excessively, one would think that that person would turn to Krishna, but when someone is suffering excessively, all they can think about is how unfortunate they are that they're suffering. A human being who is wise should never desire promotion to heavenly planets or residence in hell. Yeah. Indeed, a human being should never desire permanent residence on the earth. Does that sound odd to you, that someone would desire permanent residence on earth? I met someone like that. That he was so happy in his extended family life, he told me he wanted to take birth again and again in his own family. Yeah, he was so happy. Because, for by such absorption in the material body, one becomes foolishly negligent of one's actual self-interest. From the purport, Lord Krishna now begins to develop his conclusive proof that actually human progress lies beyond material piety and sin. The Lord first clarified that there are basically three methods of human elevation, namely jnana, karma, and bhakti, and that the goal is transcendental knowledge and ultimately love of Godhead. Now the Lord explains that promotion to heavenly planets, the final goal of piety, as well as residence in hell, the result of sinful activities, are both useless in fulfilling the actual purpose of life. Neither material piety nor sin establish the eternal living entity in his constitutional position. Therefore, something more is required to achieve the actual perfection of life. A wise person, 14, knowing that although the material body is subject to death, so this is speaking, just these three verses here was speaking onward and up to 17 even, speaking about the importance of human life, that we should be detached from material enjoyment, detached from the body. Use our time well, use our life well, use our intelligence well, use anything that we have that Krishna has given us by our fate. We should use it to gain that which is of true value. A wise person, knowing that although the material body is subject to death, it can still award the perfection of one's life. One should not foolishly neglect to take advantage of this opportunity before death arrives. So what verse is this quite similar to? Spoken by Prahlad Maharaj. Kamaram acharet pragyo dharman bhagavataniha dolabha manusha janma tarap adruva artadan. That human life is so special because if someone is able to trade something temporary for something eternal. Now that, when you think about it, is a good deal. To trade something temporary for something eternal. Because human life, our time in this body is temporary, just like everyone's time in whatever body they happen to be inhabiting. It's temporary. No one lives forever. But in human life, it's obviously different. What is the difference between human and animal life? Prabhupada would say that in the West especially, that the humans are running on four wheels and the animals are running on four legs. What's the difference? So what is the difference? Huh? Intelligence. Yes, intelligence. The soul, the body, either contracts or expands the ability to be intelligent. So human life is the full expansion of the soul's ability to be intelligent. It can expand to this degree. So we can perceive ourselves. We can think philosophically. Animals can't think philosophically. We can wonder about our future and what's going to happen when I become old. There's a self-consciousness that human beings have that causes him to contemplate deeper subjects. So if that intelligence is only used to contemplate the same things that animals contemplate, then it is unfortunate. Without attachment, and here's an interesting example. A bird gives up the tree in which his nest was constructed when that tree is cut down by cruel men who are like death personified, and thus the bird achieves happiness in another place. Knowing that one's duration of life, this is interesting. So what's the example there? That the bird is in a tree And a cruel man comes along and he just cuts down the tree, and the bird could sit there and lament and lament and lament and lament and, oh, I have my nest in the tree, oh, oh. But instead he can just fly and find another tree to live on and build another nest. So, and he achieves happiness in another place. So what's the analogy? What is that tree that is just to be given up as a temporary dwelling place? What is that tree?
Body.
It's this body that we're so attached to. It's quite a radical analogy. Just give it up. Just move on. When it's time to die, move on. Huh? What's radical about that? Excuse me? Little, very little, I'm sure. Especially when it's very far away. It's very little frightening. But how amazing is the way it's discussed. But what's... So is frightening... means what? It means being afraid. Yes? Obviously. Frightening, being afraid. So... We're teasing and saying that one shouldn't be frightened. But listen to this next verse saying that one should be frightened. Knowing that one's duration of life is being similarly cut down by the passing of days and nights, one should be shaken by fear. In this way, giving up all material attachments and desires, one understands the Supreme Lord and achieves perfect peace. So, the peace process recommended here is be afraid that here I am in a material body and I'm so attached to so many different things, especially to the body, and I extend that, project that sense of I am my body onto all my possessions. I am my bicycle. I am my bicycle is mine. I am my body and my bicycle is mine. Etc. And this hat is mine because it belongs to my body and my body uses it. And I'm so attached and my life is being shortened with every day and night, and I should be shaken by fear, the Bhagavatam says, Krishna himself says. And therefore, being frightened of my actual situation, my shallowness in realization, I should give up all material attachment and desire. And then one understands. And then doing that, one understands the Supreme Lord and achieves perfect peace. So on one hand, great fear. On the other hand, perfect peace. If one is greatly fearful, one cannot at the same time be perfectly peaceful. Fear and peace are in opposition to each other. So by understanding the Supreme Lord, the fear goes and the peace comes. So what does it mean to understand the Supreme Lord? It means to understand that myself in relationship with Him, that I am His servant and He is my Lord. And He, when I surrender to Him, He will protect me, He will care for me, He actually loves me, because Aham Bijapada Pita. And He's all merciful and all powerful. Then I can surrender. Purport. No purport. Next verse. The human body, which can award all benefits in life, is automatically obtained by the laws of nature, although it is a very rare achievement. This human body can be compared to a perfectly constructed boat, having the spiritual master as the captain and the instructions of the personality of Godhead as favorable winds impelling it on its course. So the body is the boat, the winds are the instructions, and the spiritual master is the captain who guides, beware of this, beware of these rocks, catch this favorable wind, here's where you catch the spirit, favorable wind, etc. So that is the human body. The human body affords us an opportunity to journey peacefully, successfully onward. Considering all these advantages, a human being who does not utilize his human life to cross the ocean of material existence must be considered the killer of his own soul. I read the comment of Srila Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur. Alas, one who is unfortunate may unexpectedly receive a touchstone, but then throw it away. What is a touchstone? Whatever you touch to it, any metal, it turns it into gold. So someone who is unfortunate receives something so valuable and throws it away. Tarapadruvamartadam. This principle is being explained herein. The human form of body is like a touchstone that can fulfill all desires. Human life is obtained after going through many millions of births and deaths. Only out of good fortune does a living entity receive the human form of life. The human body is compared to a plava, or boat. And the spiritual master is the helmsman who can expertly take one across the ocean of material existence. The instructions of the all-merciful Supreme Personality of Godhead are compared to favorable breezes, and by accepting them, one can quickly cross to the other side of material existence. This principle is also applicable to jnanis. A transcendentalist, having become disgusted and hopeless in all endeavors for material happiness. And now, from 18 to 26, the process of Jnana Yoga is described. The previous verses were about the importance of human life. And then the verses prior to that were about more about Karma Yoga. And then here from 18 to 26, Jnana Yoga. And then after 26, Bhakti Yoga. So after the glories of human life, the adhikara for being a jnani is described. So you listen carefully. If any of you wish to become jnanis, you can see if you have the adhikara. A transcendentalist, having become disgusted and hopeless in all endeavors for material happiness, completely controls the senses and develops detachment. By spiritual practice, he should then fix the mind on the spiritual platform without deviation. Sounds like a good idea. But it's by one's own power, though. The jnanis proceed by their own power. We'll read what Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur has to say on this point. After glorifying the human form of body, which awards one's real self-interest, the Lord describes the nature of a person who is qualified to cultivate jnana in the following verses. One naturally becomes full of anxiety as a result of experiencing the distress that is born of material activities. If he receives the good instructions of the Lord or his devotee, he can develop a mood of detachment. When one understands, the frustration can lead to even more intense endeavor unless one understands that the very nature of the material world is to cause us frustration in our material attempts for happiness. This is very hard for a materialist to accept, that there's no way you can configure the material world that you can become happy. It's essentially a place of suffering. So for us, for devotees, even for us aspiring devotees, this doesn't sound surprising at all. This is the first tenet of Buddhist doctrine also, that the material world is a place of suffering. And because Buddhism is born in the Vedic culture, born from the Vedic culture, they immediately accept this point. But it's not that, quite surprisingly, it's not that everyone accepts this. Did you know that? The whole Judeo-Christian Western world doesn't accept this point. And they think it's very cynical and very wrong if you say that the material world is essentially a place of suffering. But who is right? Is it essentially a place of suffering, or there are possibilities to be happy here? until we make that decision and come to our conclusion on that, we'll always be keeping something just in case we can find our way through to happiness in the material world. But actually, of course it's a place of suffering, because everyone dies. Everyone, not only do each of us die, everyone we love dies. And everyone we have loved will die. Sometimes we wouldn't mind if everyone we hated would die, but everyone we love also. Everyone, all the people we don't even know, neither have love or hatred for, they're all finished too. Everyone, 6 billion people in 100 years will be gone. There's like little babies just born today. 100 years from now, they'll be dead. Everyone. So is this the basic principle of a place of happiness? Hardly. But yet we stubbornly hold to the point, the mind holds to the point that I know I wasn't successful up to now, but my next, if I just get the right, my computer will now have a CD player. It has a color screen, but now if I only have a CD player attached to it, and I found that once I did get the CD player, by the way, it was didn't work at all properly, because you had to have the machine on all the time for it to work or something. And then on and on, this problem and that problem, and the battery ran out, and anyway, just didn't work, and someone else had a bigger one, a better one. But even though I'm making a joke of it, it's the mind really does tend to look to not give up its hope for the right relationship, for the right situation, for the right balance in material existence, that I can actually find the satisfaction that I'm hankering for. So the qualification for jnana here is that he's actually concluded the point. He's reached his conclusion that no, I don't want to even try anymore. I'm finished. I'm finished with the attempt to try to be happy in the material world. I want to enlarge my identity, spiritual identity. I want to become that. I want to break my identity, sense of identifying with the material world. Whenever the mind, being concentrated on the spiritual platform, is suddenly deviated from its spiritual position, one should carefully bring it under the control of the self by following the prescribed means. So the jnani has nothing to do except keep his consciousness on the spiritual platform. In fact, he can't do anything other than that. He is proscribed from doing any karma, any activity. He has to be inactive and keep his mind on the spiritual platform, trying to meditate, to hear Vedanta, to meditate on himself as an eternal soul. The senses cannot be engaged at all. And if by chance, if someone is suddenly deviated from that spiritual meditation, follow the prescribed means and immediately bring it back. How sincere one has to be, and how difficult it is. There's no engagement for the senses at all. One should never lose sight of the actual goal of mental activities. So it's happening on the mental platform. His deviation from material activities is to extract himself from the physical platform and live meditatively on the mental platform, not engaging his senses at all. So he should conquer the life air and senses, and utilizing intelligence strengthened by the mode of goodness, one should bring the mind under the control of the self. So how powerful one has to be. One has to be so fixed in goodness to succeed in this. Here is the comment of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. Even after temporarily controlling the urges of the mind, it has to be consistent too. Consistent, without stop. Even after temporarily controlling the urges of the mind, those whose senses are not under control can easily fall down from the path of self-realization. For this reason, the mind and senses should always be engaged in the service of the all-auspicious Supreme Lord. So Srila Bhaktisiddhanta is pushing one towards devotional service. When one comes to the platform of self-realization, the restless mind will no longer create obstacles, but rather will help one. The mind is material, and so it always hankers after the objects of the senses, and it is averse to the real self-interest of the spirit soul. There is no possibility of achieving self-realization without controlling the restless mind. So the mind has to be engaged. Otherwise it will cause havoc in our spiritual life. An expert, now how to control the mind? An expert horseman desiring to tame a headstrong horse, a horse that's very stubborn and untrained, which is compared to the mind here. He first lets the horse have his way for a moment, and then, pulling the reins, pulling with his mind, he gradually places the horse on the desired path. He gives it a little, and then he pulls it back. Similarly, the supreme yoga process is that by which one carefully observes the movements and desires of the mind and gradually brings them under full control. So Krishna actually says, Esha Parama Yoga. Esha Vai Parama Yoga. This is certainly the process, the supreme process to observe the mind, to witness, to watch the mind, and gradually bring it under control. Esha Parama Yoga. It's also interesting to note that in the previous chapter, the Lord said just to make the mind strong, one should practice pranayama. He said that. Here is the comment by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. Sri Krishna is here inciting the example of training a horse to show how one must check the urges of the mind. One must sometimes fulfill the demands of the mind in order to control it completely. To control the mind is the main purpose of the yoga system. One who wants to control his senses should study this example given by Lord Krishna. A horseman, although wanting to gain full control of the horse, will in the beginning let the horse have its way for a short while. Even while doing so, he continues to hold the rope and never allows it to run completely wild. And Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur comments, if the mind which runs towards material enjoyment like a horse comes to know that its goal is the Supreme Absolute Truth, its functions can be properly utilized. When the consideration of worshipping Lord Hari gradually awakens in the mind, it automatically becomes controlled. Simply by engaging the functions of the mind in the service of the eternal object, a living entity attains auspiciousness. Therefore, in order to control the mind, one should follow the path of Yukta Vairagya rather than that of Phagu Vairagya. In other words, one should engage the mind in Krishna's service is the best way to control the mind, not dryly renounce everything. 22. Until one's mind, so all this is because it's discussion of Jnana Yoga, there's so much emphasis is put on the mind. Until one's mind is fixed in spiritual satisfaction, one should analytically study the temporary nature of all material objects, whether cosmic, earthly, or atomic. So what does that mean? I'll read it again. Until one's mind is fixed in spiritual satisfaction, point one, One should analytically study the temporary nature of all material objects, too, whether cosmic, earthly, or atomic. But what is the verse actually saying? That's a comment. Huh? First point, until one's mind is fixed in spiritual satisfaction. Why is that first? That means after one's mind is satisfied, one doesn't have to do what I'm going to say. Because when one's mind is satisfied, then you don't have to control the mind because it's naturally doing what you want it to do, which is engage on the spiritual path. So until one has attained that platform of gaining satisfaction from the spiritual path, it has to be treated, the mind has to be treated somewhat differently. It has to be preached to. And how to preach to the mind, to convince it to stop engaging in its tendencies for sense gratification, one should study the temporary nature of all material objects. Why? And then it talks about three different levels, cosmic, earthly, or atomic, on the microcosm, the macrocosm, and the everyday, the experience cosm. So why?
You have to understand the temporary nature.
Yeah. So this is our basic way of preaching to people, isn't it? So when preaching to people, we don't actually preach as the way devotees preach, which is neutrality towards the material world, which is the adhikar for taking up devotional service, but actually we preach in using this jnani methodology as saying, oh, it's all temporary, you can't be happy here, it's, you're going to be miserable, get try, you're going to really suffer, ha 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 ha. You're not going to be able to be happy at all, everyone's going to die, you know, everyone you love is going to die, and there's so much suffering in these material relationships, and your car is going to break down, and your computer's going to crash, and... We have to preach in that way because everyone is so attached. But we mostly have to preach to ourselves in that way because until our mind becomes satisfied in its relationship with Krishna, we have to tell it, you know, as they say nowadays, let's not go there. That's the English-American type of slang. Let's not go there. So the mind has to be told, let's not go there. And this is the simple jnani type method that we use to tell the mind. We tell it, look, the whole universe is going to one day be destroyed and you're going to be happy here. That's the nature of the entire universe. What to speak of your little plan, the whole universe. And even on the atomic level, everything is completely changing and you're trying to find stability here. And look on Earth, look at the history of the world. Even the greatest people who had their great kingdoms, where are they now? Where is Julius Caesar? Where is this one? Where is that one? Look at the beauty of this one. Look at the beauty of that one. Look at the wealth. He spent his whole life trying to get wealth, and now where is he? Now he's someone's second dog in Sweden. Who was that? Who became the second dog in Sweden? Prabhupada said that neighbor did. He said, he didn't say that he did. He said, one astrologer said. So this is until the mind is fixed. Here's Vishwanath's comment, short comment in the Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's short comment. Here it is being explained how one can fix up his flickering mind. While engaging in Sankhya Yoga or the analytical study of the material world, one carefully considers the varieties of creation through progressive functions and annihilation through regressive functions until the mind becomes detached. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur says, one should very carefully study the processes of creation and destruction forever being carried out in the material world so that the mind can become steady on the path of self-realization. 23. When a person is disgusted, this should be the result, with the temporary illusory nature of this world, just causes suffering, adhyantavantakautaya nateshu ramate buddha, and is thus detached from it, his mind, guided by the instructions of his spiritual master, considers again and again the nature of this world and eventually gives up the false identification with matter. Through the various disciplinary regulations and the purificatory processes of the yoga system, through logic and spiritual education, or through worship and adoration of me, Krishna says, one should constantly engage his mind in remembering the personality of Godhead, yogyam, the actual Sanskrit here. The goal of yoga. No other means should be employed for this purpose. If because of a momentary inattention, a yogi accidentally commits an abominable activity, so what to do if you're trying to do it very sincerely and there's a mishap, a slip-up, and he accidentally commits an abominable activity, then by the very practice of yoga, he should burn to ashes the sinful reactions without at any time employing any other procedures. And then the final verse, and we'll read the verses and the purports of those after I finish the final verse we'll read. It is firmly declared that the steady adherence of transcendentalists to their respective spiritual positions constitutes real piety. And that sin occurs when a transcendentalist neglects his prescribed duty. One who adopts this standard of piety and sin, sincerely desiring to give up all past association with sense gratification, is able to subdue materialistic activities which are by nature impure. So, 25, Vishnu Chakravati Thakur speaks about the momentary inattentiveness of a yogi, and that he should, by his practice, own practices, not changing to other practices, no prayasthita, by his own practices, he will dissolve the problem. Commentary. The question may arise that if one who is detached from material life, along with its prescribed duties, by chance commits a sinful act, then how can he be freed from the reaction of sin without undergoing atonement, which is the prescription of the Karmakanda section of the Vedas? The answer is given here that simply by continuing his practice of yoga, all sinful reaction will be burned to ashes. Srila Srira Swami has said that for a devotee, all reactions of sinful activities can be nullified simply by hearing and chanting the holy names of the Supreme Lord. It is stated in the sixth canto of the Bhagavatam, Ketchit Kevalaya Bhaktya Vasudeva Parayana Agham Dunvantikatsneya Niharam Iva Bhaskaram. Only a rare person who has adopted complete unalloyed devotional service to Krishna can uproot the weeds of sinful actions with no possibility they will revive. He can do this simply by discharging devotional service, just as the sun can immediately dissipate fog from its rays. Elsewhere in the Bhagavatam, 5th chapter of the 11th canto, 42nd verse, Swaparamulam bhajata priyasya chaktanya bhavasya hari parisa vikamaya chod patitam katanchit dunoti savam vidisani vista. One who has given up all other engagements and has taken full shelter of the lotus feet of Hari, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is very dear to the Lord. Indeed, if such a surrendered soul accidentally commits some sinful activity, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is seated within everyone's heart, immediately takes away the reaction to such sin. And then Vishwanath concludes by saying, the word yogi in this verse refers to both the jnana yogi and bhakti yogi. And then the comment of Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, very short. The activities of the conditioned souls are of two kinds, pious and sinful. So this is the question that was originally asked. What do you mean by being indifferent to the piety
and sinful activities. So the conditioned soul does have these. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was saying, if an honest person accidentally commits some sinful activities, the reaction to those sins can be counteracted simply by engaging in the service of the Supreme Lord. There is no need for a devotee of the Supreme Lord to undergo atonement as a separate endeavor. So Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, in his comment on the next verse, he more or less answers the question. A living entity must execute his duties according to his position under the three modes of material nature. When one engages in an occupation other than that which is prescribed for him, this creates a discrepancy. The performance of prescribed duties and the avoidance of forbidden acts enables attached materialists to gradually become detached from the spirit of enjoying the fruits of their labor. As soon as one performs forbidden or sinful acts, distressful conditions are created. Just to free the conditioned soul from his distressful conditions of life, the scriptures prescribe rules and regulations to guide his behavior. So that's why the rules and regulations are given, and to push him upward so he doesn't engage in distressful sinful activities. So those are prohibited. And then the final short paragraph takes the point to its conclusion. As long as one fails to awaken his loving devotional service to the Supreme Lord, he will continue to desire the four objectives of human life, placing him under the control of the Vedic rules and regulations. When one fully engaged in a process of transcendental realization, when one is fully engaged in a process of transcendental realization, however, the mundane conception of good and bad no longer apply. So we knew that was coming, so to speak. And now Krishna will explain the process of pure devotional service. Now this has been explained in the 14th chapter, in the 12th chapter, and we've heard about it even recently in the last chapter. But he's going to explain it again, and it's quite wonderful. But we shall leave that for tomorrow. So we won't have any more of the class today, except that we will have questions, because those verses are the verses that Rani Mataji will read tomorrow. Or it did say also say on the transcendental path also. Well, one question. Well, this is the question, right? This is the same question that Uddhava asked. But here's an example. One night in Vrindavan, while the gopis were taking care of their families, cooking food, feeding their little children, the moonlight was full. And Krishna thought, this is a wonderful night to have a dance with the gopis. So he took out his flute and began to play it. And the gopis, because he knew his flute had the power, because the gopis were so chaste and so pious and so religious, the banks, their activities were controlled by their purity, just in the same way that the banks of a river control the flow of the river. So Krishna thought, how will I get them out of their houses? So he took out his flute, and that Krishna's flute playing made them so mad in transcendental ecstasy. It overpowered, made the river of their devotion to him flood over the banks. And they ran from their houses. They took their children and put them down. They left the rice cooking. They didn't dress themselves properly. And they ran to Krishna, and they didn't care for anything else. Their mind was focused on, I have to see Krishna now. I have to see Krishna now. My love for Krishna is... They weren't thinking this. They were just doing it. Now, according to material rules of piety and impiety, they had done something quite improper. But they were not on the level that those material rules of piety and impiety are made for. They were completely on the transcendental level.
So they were acting in the most pious way because their actions were meant for the pleasure of Krishna. So that is an example. Now, what do we do? Well, specifically what's being talked about is the rules and regulations that everyone in the Veda culture should follow. Ultimately, yes. So a person who's on the path of Krishna consciousness, he, Prabhupada, for example, one time chastised me for, he said that there was a fuel shortage. So some devotee was distributing a book. And he, and the devotee said to the person he was distributing a book to, that this book will tell you how to solve the fuel shortage of the world. It was Ishopanishad. So Prabhupada then said to me, actually it will. But you think you shouldn't have said that. And then he said, don't be more, but I want them to distribute the books. Don't be more a moralist than your spiritual master, he told me. He wasn't literally shaking his finger, but I was shaking anyway. Not shaking, but I heard what the point. He said that the good and bad of this world doesn't exactly apply to the devotees. Just like when the devotees were distributing, the devotees in Russia, they were handwriting their books, Prabhupada's books, and distributing them. And do you think that the then communist government was thinking that this is lawful? So according to the morality imposed by the government, it was illegal and immoral and unlawful. But from the point of view of what was good for the people in that country, from the point of view of their spiritual lives, for their eternal existence, it was completely lawful. So there were two different perspectives. So if we take the perspective, this is examples outside of the Vedic culture and the Vedic system. If we take the perspective that there is ordinary morality, and okay, but sometimes for the pleasure of Krishna, not that we can take advantage of this and do whatever we want and say it's for the pleasure of Krishna, but sometimes when Krishna directly wants something done, the devotee, he really is beyond these simple mundane laws. And that's relative according to the places. That's why I was giving the example of you wear your shoes inside the church, but you don't wear your shoes inside the temple here. One is considered really bad. Here you can kiss your dogs there. I mean there, and you can, you know, you keep them in the house, you keep your dogs and cats in bed with you and stuff like that. And here, if you do that, people will think that you're crazy. So this is mundane good and bad. If you walk into a Sikh type of temple, you have to cover your head. Even the men cover their heads. Even the Sindhis, they'll put like handkerchiefs on their heads when they, before God, you should have your head covered. But if you don't have to do that here. And there's certain standards for good and bad that are relative, and that was one of the reasons why Krishna himself defined all those things, because according to his opinion, which is the authoritative opinion, he's defining the different qualities. And so we accept his opinion, not and there's local customs too, and the local customs. And that was why Krishna asked his father, you know, about Govardhan Puja. Is this a local custom or does it have some Shastric basis? Because there's so many things that are done. Anyways, a million examples that are relative. Yeah.
Yeah. mostly in our preaching we are resorting to the jnana arguments about how life is miserable. At the same time, there are quite a few people in this world who may have a little tinge of sattva, or at least they convince themselves that they are happy and enjoying, and they just cannot accept any of these arguments. And even though maybe they may be rather good people, but they say, well, it's suffering, this world is suffering, and this life is misery for those who are not temperate, who have no temperance, or
yes.
No
yes.
Goodness of mind, and but
excessive.
If you follow the duty and everything, then you're happy. So, and they reject our preaching and our books based on our preaching with the Gan arguments. So, how would you? What is the proper way to address these people?
One way we could try to convince them you're miserable. And you say, you're miserable. No, I'm not. You are. I'm not. You are. I'm not. You are. Your mother's going to die. I don't care. I don't like her anyway. You know what? I mean, that, there's no end to that one if someone doesn't want to hear it. But of course, it's not a happy place, the material world. I mean, but if people are feeling like that, then we just bring them to Vrindavan and have a big kirtan. Because there's a level of happiness that's quite on a different level than peace and the mode of goodness can afford, which is always mixed. And maybe you could preach more directly about the personality of God and awakening one's relationship with Him. That there is actually a supreme controller of all this, and there are modes of material nature. So, if someone has the ability of goodness, then you could talk to them about the three modes of material nature, and then they could see, notice how everyone isn't good because they're not temperate, because of this and that, and they are suffering. That's because of the mode of passion and the mode of ignorance. So, there are three actual forces. So, what about transcending those? Now, what happens then? And, I mean, there's so many ways to preach, I would imagine. But also the experience of kirtan is very powerful, etc. Anyone else like to comment on this? You wanted to comment on this question?
And that was very nice what you explained, to take advantage of their goodness to drive their intelligence to understand that there is a higher happiness even than the one that they are experiencing.
Because this one is mixed.
Yeah.
They could see that, though, right? They're saying it's more or less I'm happy. So they're not saying I'm always happy, unless they're always bewildered. But so it's easy to explain that it's more or less happy. But the soul is longing for something even more than more or less happy. Because say if you're more, and then you say, is your mother more or less happy too? How about your mother's fifth husband? Is he also happy? Or how could you be happy seeing that the rest of the people in the world are really suffering? Because good people have compassion in their hearts too. So, but you have to deal with what people are, I think. Clearly, obviously, if you deal with what they're not, they don't hear you at all. And you could ask them, well, what are you interested in? What would you like to improve in yourself? So you play the part of that person. Okay? You got to get yourself in the right. Okay? Tell me when you're there. You're laughing, it's smiling, okay. Yeah, so you feel happy?
Yes.
Yeah. Do you think you could improve anything about yourself?
Maybe. My life is pretty good, okay.
What do you do?
I'm helping others and I follow my duty.
You're helping others?
Yes.
How are you helping them?
I help my relatives and friends.
Well, how do you help them? And I'm actually interested to know how you help them.
With good words and also materially.
So you help them, so that means they need help. So they're probably not as quite as happy as you are.
All together, we help each other and you're happy.
Now, how do I stop hoping that the roof doesn't cave in on your head now? You know that story of the Buddha? When the lady came to him, who is it? Her child had just died. And she said, and she was lamenting, and she wouldn't put down the dead body. And he said, and she said her heart was breaking so much she couldn't deal with it. So he said, I know how to cure you of this problem. And she was hopeful because she had some trust in him. So he said, I want you to beg me some sesame seeds in this village that we're in from someone whose house there has been no death in the family anyway. So she came back without the baby. And he asked her, where's the body of your child? She said, well, I realized that there's nobody who's not been afflicted by this. So my situation isn't so special. It's just part of material existence. So have you ever heard that story before? Yeah. What do you think about it? Oh, we're still in roll, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah,
consciousness, as you mature, then we are maybe afraid, but this is a reality of life. Yeah, people die, but you come to terms with it and just do your duty.
I remember hearing Prabhupada say, would you believe me if I told you that there is a way that you will, that when you leave this world, you go to, when you, what we call die, you can go to a spiritual world that is eternal, that is wonderful. But you think I'm a madman, something like that. So in other words, if you could change, you know, get someone thinking on a bit of a different level, because, and that means that basically we have to be thinking on a different level. So you can't think on the level of this Gyani arguments if the person is not suitable. It'd be interesting to also ask, what is the perfection of the way you're thinking and acting?
In terms of that person?
Yeah, well, I mean, you had to, with a person like that, you'd have to have a real conversation. You couldn't have a stereotype. First you tell them this, then you tell them that, then you tell them that. Yeah, what would be the perfection of a person? What would you see be the perfection of your life? I mean, that's an honest question to ask a person. And when you ask a person an honest question means a question that you're actually interested in hearing their answer to. And you're not just, you know, to have an honest conversation with a good person is a good thing, where you're not just trying to hit back everything that they say.
It seems they mostly fall into this karma mimamsa type of mentality.
I think nowadays in Kali Yuga, there are less and less of these kind of people who can perpetually keep enough piety going to keep them happy all the time, because it is, after all, an impious age. And if you're not directly afflicted, and it's hard to keep that type of a mood when someone you love is in the hospital, and then ultimately say, here, please take some prasadam, you know, I wish you well, here's my telephone number, if anyway at some point I could ever be of some service to you, let me know. Okay, this would be an interesting topic to continue on, but why don't we just stop instead, because it's 12:30 now. So tomorrow's class shall begin at the usual time at 10:30, and Mother Narayani will continue with the ecstatic description of Bhakti Yoga. And then the whole Vedic path will be described in relationship to what Krishna wants to speak about. Because in every chapter, he's bringing everything always to the point of bhakti, always showing karma leads to jnana, jnana leads to bhakti. Bhakti is the thing. Krishna himself is saying that love for me is the goal. Develop your love for me. Okay, thank you very much. Do you mind if I go tell him to teach us the profile?